Obama has vowed to veto any repeal bill. That pretty much assures that the law will remain in place for at least the next 2 years. The poll also found a large majority, more than 60%, disapproves of efforts to defund the law. The House voted to do that last week. But even those who would like to see the measure repealed said taking away funding is, quote, not the way our government should work. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
A large turnout is expected at Florida's Cape Canaveral this afternoon for Shuttle Discovery's final space launch. Its mission is to take 6 crew members, a humanoid robot, and supplies to the International Space Station. Discovery was previously scheduled to go up last November, but engineers detected a hydrogen fuel leak and cracks in the fuel tank that NASA's team says are now fixed. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from U.S. Oncology. 1,300 oncologists united to bring cancer care to local communities across America at usoncology.com.
Thank you for responding to our call to share your comments about federal funding with your congressional representative. Because the future of WILL and public broadcasting is at stake, it is important that your elected representatives hear directly from you about whether or not funding for public broadcasting should be continued. An easy way to stay informed is to sign up at 170millionamericans.org. That's 170millionamericans.org. Thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, Lawrence Goldstone, author of Inherently Unequal, about the Supreme Court's decisions on civil rights after the Civil War during Reconstruction.
The rulings were so Byzantine and so bizarre, but taken one after the other, they slowly squeezed the life out of the 14th and 15th Amendments.
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. At Jason Croft's at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on hour number one. Our producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Since 9/11, something like 2 million Americans, in round figures, have been sent to serve in Iraq or in Afghanistan. And as a result, millions of family members, spouses, children, parents, siblings, have all had to cope with the deployment of somebody in their family. Certainly, these experiences can be real tests of family resources, both personal and economic. And one thing we certainly know is that the challenges do not end when soldiers come home. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll try to talk some about military families, their experiences, their needs, and perhaps also talk about what's being done to provide support for these families. And our guest for the show is Shelley McDermid Wadsworth. She's professor of family studies and is also director of the Military Family Research Institute at Purdue University. And she is here visiting the campus. Her visit is sponsored by the Department of Human and Community Development. And she'll be giving a talk, talking about, I'm sure, some of her research. The topic of her talk is The Long Way Home, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Small Town USA. And she will be speaking tonight, 7 o'clock, at the auditorium of the Spurlock Museum on the campus. That's at South Gregory, 600 South Gregory. It's in Urbana. And this is free and open to anybody who would like to attend. So certainly, if you would like to stop in and hear what she has to say, you should feel welcome. And here on this program, as always, questions are welcome. We hope people can try and be brief and be on the topic, but you're certainly welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And also, you can send us an email, will-talk at illinois.edu. So at any point here you'd like to be a part of the conversation, you can do that. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Maybe it would be interesting to talk a little bit just as a way of starting to talk about something of the history of the Military Family Research Institute and how it came to be.
It was a very unexpected turn in my career. I had spent, by the time the Institute was created, a number of years studying the relationships between work conditions and family life, and I was aware that military life posed both extreme work but also extreme family support in many ways compared to where much of corporate America was at that time. The Department of Defense issued a call for proposals to create such an institute, and I joined a team at Purdue that was writing a proposal, and we were successful in winning the competition for the funding, and that set us off. So we've been around now for about 10 years.
And I get the general sort of impression that while now people like you who study family dynamics are starting to give some attention to particular issues that apply to military families, that it's actually not something that had been very much a subject of research maybe before a few years ago.
That's what I thought too when I started. But as I dug back a little bit more, what I came to understand was that time in the research world moves a little differently when it comes to military issues, particularly around families. What I found was that there were pretty large bursts of research following each major conflict. So following World War II, following Vietnam especially, not so much the first Gulf War because it was so short, but those conflicts generated quite a bit of scholarship about families, more so Vietnam than World War II. But the interesting thing about World War II is that Reuben Hill, a family sociologist, conducted a very seminal study of farm families reuniting in Iowa following the war, and that became foundational, really, for my discipline and generated something that later became family stress theory that continues to be very influential today. So as in the study of families, as in other domains of study, the study of families has really benefited from scholarship that's been generated by conflict. It's sort of an ironic benefit, but it's true in medicine and many other domains that innovation is spurred by this heavy need.
Yeah. In thinking about this and trying to think about our conversation, I find myself thinking, well, are there some ways in which the place that we are now is really different from where we've been? And I suppose on one level, it's been some time before people were being called up to serve in the numbers that we have. So, you know, that might be one difference. And just as we were talking here a little bit before we got going, it seemed to me that maybe one difference, and you said not exactly sure, but maybe one difference would have something to do with the numbers of women who were serving. At least I have this feeling that in the past few conflicts that I can remember, say before the first Gulf War, we didn't see so many instances. You know, we would have seen times when families were seeing off men, you know, dads, sons, brothers. But that now one of the things that was different is that more and more we were seeing families who were seeing off daughters and moms and wives. And there seemed to me like this was really something different. I know here, just before we got going, we were chatting a little bit, and you said, well, you weren't exactly sure whether that really is different. Maybe it has something to do with the kind of roles that they're taking are different.
It is interesting to think about how conflicts are different, because all you have to go on is what has been tried in other conflicts and what can you learn from that. As I've read more about the Second World War, one of the things that is very striking to me is the percent of the population that was serving in the military. Mm-hmm. At that time, 1 in 10 members of the population served in the military. 1 in 10. Today, it's 1 in 100. And so when you think about the impact on daily life of the conflict, World War II permeated every moment of every day for many people for a very long time, with, of course, much less communication between deployed family members and families back home. So that war was striking in many ways when you think about family phenomenon. And the numbers of people involved was enormous, obviously, but there were many women who served, not necessarily on the front lines, but who served. Women were pilots. Women, of course, worked in the factories. Women drove ambulances. Lots of women's involvement. In Vietnam, we had conscription again, but primarily of young men. And a different kind of rotation cycle than is being used now. And so many, many people went. lots of cycling through. People were not making the military a career then because we had conscription. You didn't necessarily need to try to retain people because you could always cycle through more people in a time of war. Again, women served in large numbers in medical professions in particular, but it would take a little digging to just check out how many actually were over there versus over here and in what roles. In this conflict, we have a number of things that are different. One, we have an all-volunteer force. So everyone who's serving has chosen to serve in the military. And since 1973, the military has been competing with private employers for its workforce. So it's worked much harder to retain service members. And that means that there are people who are older and who have families. Second, we had a big drawdown in the size of the military in the 1990s by about 30%. And that means that today we're relying much more heavily on the reserve component than we ever have in recent memory, certainly in the memory of anyone today serving. And so the impact on every little town and city is bigger than was the case in certainly the first Gulf War, but maybe even in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Women today have access to many more occupations in the military than they have historically. So today, it's, I believe, 95% of military occupations are open to women. Submarines just opened to women, and women are receiving combat badges, even though they're not allowed to serve in units whose primary mission is frontline combat. Women are the medics who go to rescue the people who have been shot in the frontline combat. So they're there. And the discussions are increasing about, okay, so when do we decide that they're just going to be there? It does raise some very interesting questions. What are the implications for families when women are the ones who are being deployed? But for me, it also raises a really interesting question about, well, how come we never talk more about the implications for families of fathers deploying? We talk a lot about male service members going and separation from family and all of that. But when you read about military families historically, we don't read a lot about service members as fathers and their experience of being a father away from their child and how they try to cope with that. So while I think there certainly might be some distinct issues about women being deployed, there are also some issues about fathers that probably we haven't talked enough about.
Yeah, I guess you'd have to say that for the kind of worry and anxiety that parents experience about their children being away from them and the difficulties of becoming part of the family again when you come back, it's going to be there. It doesn't matter whether you're a mom or a dad or a man and woman. I would think the same things would apply.
I think the issues are similar. They look different, I think, in different families, depending upon how parents handled things prior to the deployment and how they're handling them when they come home. If the parent who gets deployed is the parent who was doing the frontline parenting, and in most U.S. households, that's the wife or the mother. The person who's arranging play dates, the person who's supervising homework, the person who's planning meals, the person who's choosing after-school activities or coordinating childcare. If that's the person who gets deployed, that's going to have probably a more powerful and noticeable impact on day-to-day life in the household as if it's the other person who gets deployed. And I think that's what raises the question about, well, it must be especially bad when moms go, because moms are typically the ones who do that. So that might be right. Dads often are the ones who help children learn especially about gender, for example. And so I've heard many both humorous and poignant stories from men who have returned from deployment to find a daughter who looked like a child when they left and who now looks like a younger version of her mother. Very much like her mother looked when her father and her mother started dating, for example. And that's a very unsettling experience for fathers, especially when they haven't been together for the whole time to see that emerge. So parents do play different roles, and the implications of deployment may vary depending upon that. But you're right. Everybody has to find their way back into the family when they return, and that experience goes differently in every family. Another thing that I think is getting very little attention these days but is also different from prior wars is that a substantial number of service members who are deploying are step-parents. And they may have children who don't live with them. They may have stepchildren who do live with them. I've certainly heard anecdotes about relatively new stepmothers, for example, suddenly being left at home with a teen who's not their biological child and trying to figure out how to become the primary parent all of a sudden. So that's something that's different now that I'm not sure we've really fully grasped.
Our guest, let me introduce again, our guest is Shelley McDermid Wadsworth. She is professor of family studies and is also director of the Military Family Research Institute at Purdue University and is here visiting the campus. We'll be giving a talk this evening on the campus. Questions are welcome. We're talking about some of the research that she has done about military families and what the experience is like when someone goes off to deployment, and then what it's like when they come back. And questions are welcome. Questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it's clearly that we have a different kind of military, as you say, in the sense that we don't have a draft. That particularly in recent years, the military has really needed all the people they can possibly get. So there's really a demand for service people. So here, maybe in a way that hasn't been true before, recruiting people and keeping people, you know, that's a big priority. And so that probably means, I imagine it means that the military has to deal with family issues maybe in a way that they haven't before, or that they're being forced to think about, well, if we're trying to attract people, what sort of complications are there if people who are coming in have families? And, you know, how do we help people deal with their family issues so that we don't have a situation where we have a lot of people leaving because they say, I can't do both. I really would like to. My family is really important to me. Serving my country is really important to me. I'd like to do both, but I have to choose here, and I'm going to go with my family.
Certainly, family issues have always gotten a lot of attention from the military, almost from the first days that we have had a military in this country. There are quotes from Abraham Lincoln and others about caring for the widows and orphans of people who have given their lives for their country. That's the motto on which the VA was created. But it is also true that in the last 10 years, I think military leaders have come to understand families in a different way. Suicide rates have made a big impact both in the popular press but also on the minds of leaders. And one of the most consistent factors in suicide is relationship problems. And that has brought family issues to the surface in ways that maybe they hadn't been brought before. We also, associated with the military today, have more family members than we do service members. Not surprising if you think about someone having a spouse and a child or one or two children. Even if we don't expand the definition of family to include parents and siblings and cousins and all the rest, which in most cases official definitions do not include, we still have more family members than we do service members for whom the Department of Defense has an expressed obligation in terms of health care and other things. But service members have said very clearly that it's very hard for them to do their military jobs when they are worried about their families at home. And people do leave because they feel that they have to choose between their family lives and their military careers. And people leave who don't really want to leave. There are many people who feel called to military service and leave it reluctantly. So there have been a variety of ways that services to families have really expanded over the course of the war. Military child care, for example, had been transformed in the decade prior to the war from some of the worst child care in the world to some of the best. But there's a shortage of it. And when you think about a very large military installation being located in a fairly rural area, the local community is unlikely to be able to provide sufficient facilities to provide care for those children, and you've got parents who need to work a demanding job that may have long hours. And so investments, military investments in child care have gone up enormously. They run the largest child care system in the world with centers, hundreds of centers around the world that they are making available to service members and their families. They also have a system for family child care a subsidy system so that people can receive care even in communities with some subsidies. But the thing that's really different about this war is that thanks to base realignment and closure and thanks to the size of the drawdown in the force, it's no longer possible to rely on installations as the place where you can deliver services. Most even active duty service members don't live on base. And so if you're going to serve all military families, then you've got to have a way to serve them everywhere, no matter where they live. And that, I think, has been the biggest transformation in the last 10 years, is that now there are efforts to try to serve everybody wherever they are and to find mechanisms to do that that don't rely on building bricks and mortar child care centers, for example, on installations.
Yeah.
That model won't reach everybody. It won't reach nearly everybody. So that, I think, has been really a head-scratcher for military leaders, and they've been working very hard on it.
Yeah. And I'm sure that also that gets to be more acute because the numbers of soldiers, of service people required, means that we have been reaching more deeply into the reserves and into the National Guard. And those are people who not only they may not live on a base, they don't even live near a base. I mean, they're people who are living in the community, in the civilian community. And the kind of support structure that might be available for them if they were really living with a lot of other military families wouldn't be there because their neighbors, the people next door and the people across the street, they're not military families, so they're not going through the same kind of stuff.
It's absolutely true. I think the assumption when the reserve component was created was that, you know, they would have community supports to rely upon, and that's why the military didn't need to do so much for them. And in part, that's true, although another assumption that the military made was that extended family members wouldn't really be very available to active component service members because they would live far away from them and be moving. And I've been impressed, actually, with the degree to which extended families have really stepped up, sometimes in some really extreme ways, like moving to Okinawa to take care of a child for an extended period of time while someone's deployed. The problem in civilian communities, I think, is that the members of the reserve component are now facing the same kinds of gaps in service and shortages in systems that civilian families face. But these are people to whom the country has made a promise that needs to be fulfilled because it needs people to keep making that promise. And so when you have large parts of the country that, for example, don't have easy access to someone who can provide mental health care for a child or an adolescent, civilian families deal with that every day. But now we have reserve component families who have faced challenges, some of whom have children who really do need assistance, and we're recognizing, oh my goodness, these same shortages we're now vulnerable to in ways that we haven't been before. And what are we going to do about that?
We have a caller here. Let's bring him in. Someone in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been, in terms of the focus on the children, any long-term, you know, sort of like a longitudinal study of children, you know, what's happened to them and the impact? I mean, it certainly is a different life.
It certainly is a different life. You're very correct. There has not yet been a lot of longitudinal research, but there are several studies underway, and one longitudinal study was just recently released by the RAND Corporation. It's available on their website, and they did a short-term longitudinal study of children, I want to say sort of fifth grade to through high school, but don't quote me on that because I might not be remembering it right. And I think what we see is a mix. First of all, military children avoid many of the risks that would cause civilian children, put civilian children at great risk. For example, every military child has a parent who has a high school education at least. Every military child has access to health care. Every military child has easier access to high-quality child care than many civilian children would have access to. So military children perhaps start a little bit ahead of civilian children. On the other hand, military members typically have a higher than expected prior exposure to sexual assault and childhood abuse. And so their children, of course, have parents who have disproportionately had those experiences. And we don't really know what that means for the risks and opportunities that those children face. What the data seem to be showing is that most military children do fine on average. They look very much like civilian children. And in fact, in achievement test scores, military children compete very well with civilian children, especially minority military children do very well relative to their civilian counterparts. There is, however, a substantial minority of military children who do show signs of elevated distress, often anxiety. And there are about three studies so far that seem to be suggesting that it is cumulative exposure to deployment, combat deployment of a parent that is responsible or at least related to that. I think a lot of us are a little hesitant to endorse that because we keep thinking that there's got to be something about the number of arrivals and departures that children are experiencing that is relevant, but it's very hard to measure those because military members are in and out so often, not just for deployment, but for other things. So I think the jury's still out on that, but there are three studies so far showing that it looks like it's cumulative exposure to deployment. So I would say there's cause for some concern, but it's not the case that children are irrevocably damaged by deployment or that we should assume that that would be the case. As in other kinds of crises or challenges, most people, it turns out, are resilient. But there is a substantial minority who we need to keep an eye on and perhaps offer additional services to.
Yeah, I would think that this conflict is that the way the turnover, you know, you see these young children that they're worrying like crazy about their parents, you know, that kind of thing, you know, when they're serving, that kind of thing. I'm just wondering over the long term that this isn't somewhat of a different situation, you know, than in the past, whether you say conflicts.
Sure, it may be. One of the things we know about children that comes through over and over and over again is that how children do depends a lot on who's caring for them. So if the at-home caregiver is doing a good job of providing a stable, predictable environment for children, and if that person is relatively skilled at listening to children's worries and reassuring them appropriately and sharing information appropriately, children tend to do much better than if that's not the case. We do know from studies of Vietnam, there were certainly parents who were deployed during Vietnam, that the children who were the most vulnerable, who experienced the most difficulty, were children whose parents came back with symptoms related to their combat exposure or other kinds of life-altering injuries. People who were simply deployed and even people who were in combat, rates of concern about children were lower, or rates of problems among children were lower. But when service members had symptoms or had injuries, that is a much more serious risk factor for children and much more likely to have long-term effects.
We are just a little bit past the midpoint in this hour of focus. Let me introduce our guests once again. Maybe you've just tuned in. We're talking with Shelley McDermid Wadsworth. She's professor of family studies and director of the Military Family Research Institute at Purdue University. And she is here visiting the campus sponsored by the Department of Human and Community Development. She'll be talking on the topic, The Long Way Home, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Small Town USA. She'll be giving a talk this evening, 7 o'clock, in the Spurlock Museum Auditorium at 600 South Gregory in Urbana, and that's open to anybody who would like to attend. Questions, other questions are also welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, email will-talkit@illinois.edu. You were just talking about the fact that what we know from past conflicts is that it is a complicating factor if a parent comes home with injuries, whether those are psychological injuries or those are physical injuries. That's a real challenge for the family and can be a problem for kids. Well, we certainly know that in Iraq and Afghanistan, people have come home with physical injuries. People who – and it's part of the nature of the military experience in military medicine that we have people who are surviving injuries that in past wars that they wouldn't have survived. So we're coming home with people who have profound injuries. We're learning more and more about traumatic head injuries that maybe not produce visible wounds but have really profound effects. And combat stress is something that we certainly know about. So what does that mean for families when you have somebody who comes home but comes home hurt?
Certainly any kind of life-altering circumstance is a challenge for families. Even if someone fully recovers and the family reestablishes its new normal, it's a transition, and it's one that people don't necessarily expect and they may not welcome. It may turn out fine in the end, but it is a challenge. It's a good news, bad news story. As you've pointed out, many of the people who are returning injured today would have returned in body bags from Vietnam. And so that part of it is really a wonderful story. And there have been enormous advances in medicine to try to help folks. And there have been many advances in the treatment of psychological injuries as well. And I think one of the most important messages, both for service members but also for the people who love them and people in communities, is that many psychological injuries can be treated and taken care of. So if someone thinks they have PTSD and they do have PTSD, that doesn't mean they're going to be dealing with PTSD for the rest of their lives. There are effective treatments, and people who are listening who may be worried about their own mental health, I really encourage them to seek help, because there's so much that can be done, and there's so much work going on to find even new and even better resources to be helpful. So if anyone is out there suffering, please don't do it in silence. Please get help. But certainly for families, it can be challenging. And some of the aspects of the most common mental health injuries, depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, don't cope very well with relationships. For example, if you're having trouble with anger management, that makes it especially challenging to be around a young child who's being particularly annoying that day. Or if you're feeling withdrawn, it's pretty hard to suck up the energy to go out and play ball with your child or participate in family events. Traumatic brain injury is something that we all are paying much more attention to. And in fact, the war, I think, has probably spurred us to think much differently about even sports-related brain injuries. Mm-hmm. The kinds of discussions we're having about concussion today are very different than they were 10 years ago. And that may be a positive outgrowth of the war. But there's no doubt that that injury in particular, I think, is really an unknown quantity for us and is going to pose some challenges that we don't yet quite know the shape of. And so it's been a relief to see the number of IED injuries go down over the course of the war, but it's definitely a concern for the future.
Let's talk with some other folks here. Belgium next, line four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
I don't know if your studies have ever discussed a particular aspect of military life, and it's probably something that probably never even came across your mind, I'm thinking. I grew up in a military family, a career officer, traveled extensively all through my youth, and the thing that has really bothered me the most about it is that it's impermanence. In other words, every time I turned around, I was going someplace else. You don't get very strong friendships built. Your family root type situations, you're not rooted to a community at all. You're always moving. Have you ever thought about that, how it affects children?
Well, first, let me thank you for your service and your family.
No, ma'am. My father was in the service.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said you served as well.
Yeah, I served also. But
you did. That's exactly right.
But the service I had was nothing like my father's.
Right.
He was in every war you can think of until these recent ones. And it affects our family. It really does affect the family. That's so much that you move. Not so much really any kind of violence or anything like that. It's just the impermanence.
I certainly understand that concern. I've thought about it in some ways that are a little different than what you've thought about, but it doesn't surprise me at all to hear that you would feel that, because some military children move at incredible rates.
Ma'am, I might point out that I went to 14 schools by the time I graduated from high school.
I was just going to ask you that, because, so what branch of service was your father in?
He was in the Marine Corps.
I wondered, because we do see patterns of, in some branches of service or in some occupational specialties, it does seem that people's careers really sort of encourage them to move very frequently to pursue training opportunities and, you know, upward mobility in their careers. Some people seem to be able to find ways to stay put for quite a while, and the military has been trying this home basing concept to try to slow it down a little, but it is a challenge. So what brought you here? Does this feel like home now?
My parents were originally from Illinois. And so I'm sure you know about this. Every military personnel gets 30 days leave.
Yes.
And every year, and usually it was on trips from one coast to the other. And you don't know how many miles I've spent on blacktop roads, two-lane blacktop roads, all the way through my youth, back and forth across the United States, many, 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 many times. And that's not the only thing, because sometimes when you get in these military areas, like wherever around the D.C. area, Southern California, different places where there's concentrated military bases, you may be there for 2 or 3 years, but because of the situation, and especially back in the 50s and the 60s when the population was growing because of baby boomers, you'd be moved from school to school to school to school to school.
That's right, and it still happens when people have to do what I call two-hop moves. They go to temporary housing.
Yes.
While they wait for the permanent housing, and they
exactly
end up changing schools. Well, you raise a really good point. I think a lot of people are talking about it and thinking about it. With regard to this war, one of the things I've thought about is young unmarried service members who, during deployment, essentially become homeless because a year is too long to maintain their leases and that sort of thing, and their social networks sort of disperse during the deployment. And I wonder what that means for their ability to start a family when they return on the sort of schedule that they had hoped for. I have noticed that a lot of military people seem to be very polished at meeting strangers and forming amicable relationships with people that they don't know very well, but you're sharing the painful part of that, which is that you've had to do it so much in your life.
Well, everybody that I know says that I don't know a stranger, because I'll talk to anybody, as Mr. Inge will tell you.
Well, thank you very much for your question and your comment.
Thanks for the comment. And you just, something you said points at I know one of the areas of research that people are looking at. So we've talked about some of the challenges faced by people who have children. Well, you know, something like half of the people deployed, yes, they have children, but there's also this other half that don't, and that I think, you know, people who do the kind of research that you do say, hey, here's another population. You know, people who are single, they have family issues too. Their family issues may be a little bit different from the family issues of people who are married and have children, but they have family issues as well. And that's another kind of unstudied group.
It's true. We've thought quite a bit about single service members, and there has been some work done, and they've been recognized for a long time. When we go to welcome home ceremonies, it's often the case that there'll be a special contingent there to make sure that single service members get welcomed because their families may not be able to be there for them. But it's still kind of sad in a way when there are all these young women and young children running across the gym floor to find their husbands and their fathers, and here are these single service members who may be heading out the back door because there's no one there to meet them. It's a very poignant sight. Although the service members have been recognized, I think that, as I pointed out, the definition of family in the military still, in most instances, does not include parents. And yet, many of the people who are being wounded and injured or who have needed special assistance during this war are not married. And it's their parents who typically step up to care for them, or their siblings. And although the military has thought a lot about, quote, family readiness and the need for families to be well prepared to support their service members in the event of their deployment or their injury or their death, typically that has meant spouses and children. And this war has really revealed that parents and siblings cannot be ignored. And so, for example, at Walter Reed, whoever a service member tells them is their family will get treated as their family. It doesn't matter who it is. If they serve in that role for the service member, then they will be welcomed and treated as though they are a blood family member, because they are essential to the service member being able to recover and resume normal life. But it's hard to do that. You can't do that across the board. For example, I don't think most taxpayers would be very happy with the idea of DOD extending health care benefits to parents and siblings and cousins and, you know, best friends. But I don't think DOD has fully confronted the range of the challenge. Fiancés and girlfriends and boyfriends don't have any status. And there's been discussion about how the benefits that the military provides to families have turned out to be kind of a unintended incentive to marry, because if you're engaged and you get sent to Korea for 3 years, you don't get to take your fiance, but you could take your wife or your husband. So that is an area that I think people are still grappling with a little bit. And there's a lot that we don't know about the implications for that population of their deployment for later life in terms of the establishment of their families. We've focused a lot on divorce and worries about the stability of marriage as a function of deployment. We haven't really spent a lot of attention on the formation of marriage.
Just about 10 minutes left. Again, our guest is Shelley McDermott Wadsworth. She's professor of family studies and director of the Military Family Research Institute at Purdue University. She's on campus. We'll give a talk tonight about military families, and questions here are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I served in Iraq from 03 and 04, and since then I've been treated for, you know, minor depression off and on, under control. And I've heard some information that some of the symptoms of depression might also be adrenal fatigue, and I was wondering if the guest knew anything about whether the military, medical, or mental health communities are addressing that or looking into that in any way. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your question, and thank you for your service. And I'm glad that you've been able to get some help for your depression. That's a good success story. I'm not a medical expert, so I don't have good answers for you about that. But there is something called the Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. It has an acronym that's just those words, CDMRP. And you can see there a list of all of the studies that they have funded, so you can see what DOD is working on. VA, of course, is also devoting a great deal of attention to the sequelae of combat. But it is true that I think many people are very focused on PTSD, which occurs. Depression and PTSD go together often, but not always. And so I hope it's not the case that the issue that you're raising is something that's not getting as much attention as it should be because people are so focused on PTSD. But I certainly encourage you to check it out. And if you have trouble getting answers, the host of the show could get you in touch with me, and I can try to find someone who could answer your question for you.
Sure. Okay. We got 3-4 minutes left. Again, it's 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Suddenly, I'd just like to come back to for a moment here, and we have talked about, and there certainly has been reporting, about the challenges families face when someone who has been deployed comes back, when they get back together again. All kinds of challenges. And I'm wondering about the divorce rate and whether, in fact, the divorce rate for people in the military is higher than it is for civilians. Or is it actually close to being the same?
Well, you know, you ask interesting questions. In general, on average, marriage rates in the military are high, particularly for men, and divorce rates are low, particularly for men, relative to the civilian population. Military members do marry young. There's a burst of young marriage, which is probably that group of people who have been kind of incented to marry unintentionally. And they also tend to have their children in their 20s as opposed to in their teens or in their 30s, which are more common in the civilian community. Women's marriages in the military are much more fragile than those of men. They're less likely to marry. If they marry, their marriages are more likely to break up. And they're much, much more likely than men to be married to someone who's another service member. So they're much more likely to be in dual military marriages. Over the course of the war, divorce rates have come up some, not noticeably, but not radically. The single largest study that's been done that is longitudinal and large sample was done by Ben Carney, also at RAND. And what they were able to do was follow marriages from 2002 to 2005. So people who got married in 2002 and what happened to those marriages over the next 3 years. And what they found was that for those people, number of days of deployment was actually negatively related to divorce. So it almost looked like deployment was good for those marriages. Now, no one would think that that was the end of the story. Mrs. Casey, the wife of the chief of the Army, says that, well, nobody had time to get divorced because they were deployed. And we all know that divorces take a long time to happen. So I think the jury is still out on that. Someone asked Ben Carney once, why do you think the divorce rate has gone up? And he said, well, that's really the wrong question. The right question is, why hasn't the divorce rate gone up a lot more? And maybe the answer is that all these things that the military has been doing to try to support families have actually been working, and that it's not gone up nearly as much as you might expect, given what families have experienced. I don't know the full right answer. I'm not sure if we will. It's hard to study because people pass through the military. They're entering and leaving all the time, and it's hard to follow marriages across all those transitions. But certainly we have not seen any exponential increase in divorce over the course of the war.
Something else that And it, I want to maybe connect a little bit to the talk that you're going to give, or the title of the talk, and something that certainly would be worth an entire conversation. You talked earlier about, for example, if you compare World War II to today, that the percentage of the population that was in the military of World War II was compared to what it is now, was enormous, and that now the percentage is much smaller. Something else that I think we have certainly seen in recent conflicts is that the proportion of people that come from small towns is also higher than from a bigger town. And you would also expect that in a smaller town, you have people go off to the military. It's more noticeable just because the population is smaller, and it can have a much more profound effect on a small town depending upon who it is and what their role in that community is. And I wonder how much you have looked or people have looked particularly at the effect of the recent wars that we've had on life in smaller communities in the United States.
It's certainly something that we think a lot about because we're located in Indiana. Indiana has a very large National Guard population. It has no large military installation. And so the problem is interesting in the sense that military members are very common. They're everywhere in the state, but they are at low density. There's never a critical mass. So in a school, for example, you're not going to find 100 military children in a school. You're going to find one or two or maybe five or 10. But you'll find them in maybe every school in the state. And so it presents a challenging kind of issue about how do you help those children in a cost-effective and efficient way, given how dispersed they are. Because military kids don't always want to be outed. They don't always want everybody knowing. And so that's been a challenge that we have thought a lot about, and it is new, I think, in this conflict compared to others.
Hmm. Well, so we're coming down to the point where we have about a minute left. Generally speaking, I don't know if you could answer this question in a minute, but the question is, well, how are we doing? I mean, how are we doing in trying to support the needs of families who have members who are deployed and then who come back?
There are lots of things that are impressive. Private foundations, communities, states, companies, others have stepped up in many creative and extensive ways to support military families. And, of course, the military also has given families a lot of priority. But we are in a period that I think is very critical. We have not yet seen the peak in the costs of the Vietnam War. They are still rising every year, the costs of that war. Mm. If we don't want people to be homeless in 20 years, we have to be thinking really hard right now about what we're doing, and I think there's a lot of work left to do.
Well, there, we're going to have to stop with our thanks to the guest, Shelley McDermid Wadsworth. She's professor of family studies and is also director of the Military Family Research Institute at Purdue University. And if you're interested in finding about the Institute and looking at some of the things they do, you can go online and go to their website. And if you'd like to hear more from her, she will be giving a talk. She'll be speaking on the topic, The Long Way Home, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Small Town USA. Her talk is tonight, 7 o'clock, on the U of I campus. This will be taking place in the auditorium of the Spurlock Museum, which is a pretty cool place. You should just go and see the museum for general principles, but go and see the talk at Spurlock. That's at 600 South Gregory in Urbana, 7 o'clock tonight. And her visit here is sponsored by the Department of Human and Community Development. And thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it very much.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, featuring an evening of Mozart, Chopin, and Beethoven with Opole Philharmonic of Poland on Thursday, February 24th at 7:30 p.m. More information about upcoming events is available at krannertcenter.com. WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, offering more than 3,000 certified organic products, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar and bulk foods department, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
And that's it for Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. In Kansas City, March wheat trading at 867 and a quarter, down 11 and a half. May 878, down 12 and a quarter. March wheat in Chicago, 746, down 17. May, 781, down 17 and a quarter. March corn, 685 and a half, down 6. May, 695 and three quarters, down 6 and a half. July, $7 and one quarter cent, down 6 and three quarters. September, 631 and a half, down 8 and three quarters. March beans, 1314 and three quarters, down 5 and a quarter. May, 1326 and a half, down 5. July, 1334 and a half, down 5 and 3 quarters. August, 1321 and a quarter, down 7 and a half. March meal, 350.